The following views and opinions do not necessarily reflect those of Talk 1230 WYTS, its staff, management, or parent company, Clear Channel. Listeners should not use Dr. Kvitko's comments and advice in place of receiving an actual dental exam. Time now for Dentally Speaking on Talk 1230 WYTS with Dr. Brian Kvitko. Call 821-1230, that's 821-1230, to discuss your dental issues. Now here's Dr. Kvitko on Talk 1230 WYTS.
Talk 1230 WYTS, welcome to Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kvitko. Thanks for joining me this morning. Keep in mind, the show is also known as Everything You've Always Wanted to Know About Dentistry, But We're Too Numb to Ask. Hello, I'm General Dentist Dr. Brian Kvitko, and today we're going to be talking about sedation and pain control in dentistry, and we have a guest with us here in the studio, Dr. Joel Weaver. I'll give you Dr. Weaver's bio here in just a second, but before I do, I want to do a couple things. I want to give everyone Dr. Kvitko's question of the day. And remember, you can call in with your guesses to 821-1230, or you can send us an email to dentallyspeakingontalk1230@yahoo.com. All right, the question of the day is, as of a 2006 survey that was done by the American Dental Association, what percent of dentists surgically place implants? All right. What percent of dentists surgically place implants? And that's according to an ADA survey that was completed in 2006. I realize it's a little bit old, but I guess collecting this kind of data can be a little bit cumbersome, and so that's the best we have at this point, at least from the ADA. Later in the show, I have the results of another survey that maybe aren't as scientific, but it'll just enlighten you a little bit. All right, and then also, before we move forward, you've heard me talk about the Buddy Walk several weeks in a row here, how we had our golf outing to raise money for the Buddy Walk. That's the Central Howe Down Syndrome Association Buddy Walk. And it is taking place today. And in fact, registration began 9 minutes ago. It's at Crew Stadium. And I will be going there directly from here, because we are supporting one of our patients, Libby Turner. We have a team called Libby's Tooth Buds. So 9 o'clock is when you register. It goes till 1 p.m. Local celebrities like Andrea Camburn, Dino Tripodis will be there. Arnett Howard will be leading the walkers with his heartwarming trumpet call. And the participants will walk around Crew Stadium. And there'll be post-walk activities like live band, raffle, face painting, and many more. So we encourage you to come out and do that and show your support. If you can't do that, maybe you could go to the website and make a donation in the name of Libby's Tooth Buds. And when you type that in, there can't be an apostrophe. So just Libby or Libby's, and you can get to our team and donate in the name of Libby Turner. Be much appreciated. All right. Now, one more quick announcement, and that is December 6th and 7th is the Women's Expo. And I will be participating, and in fact, we'll be giving away some free tickets for that event here soon. But right now, what I'd like to do is welcome my guest, Dr. Joel Weaver. Dr. Weaver received his B.S. in pharmacy from Ohio Northern University in 1968, and his D.D.S. from The Ohio State University in 1972. After his four-year National Institute of Dental Research-sponsored residency in anesthesiology and pharmacology, he received a Ph.D. from The Ohio State University in 1976. He then joined the OSU faculty and maintained a dual appointment as a professor in the College of Dentistry and in the Department of Anesthesiology in the College of Medicine. Dr. Weaver practiced as a dental anesthesiologist in the College of Dentistry's clinics and in the hospital operating rooms at OSU for more than 30 years. He doesn't even look old enough to have done that. He was also director of a 27-month master's degree anesthesia residency program for general dentists and taught pharmacology to dental students. He retired from his full-time academic position in 2007 and was honored by The Ohio State University to receive the title of Professor Emeritus. Dr. Weaver is a past president of both the American Dental Society of Anesthesiology and the American Dental Board of Anesthesiology. He is currently president of the American Society of Dentist Anesthesiologists, the American Dental Association's national media spokesperson for anesthesia, and is the editor of the Dental Anesthesia Scientific Journal, Anesthesia Progress. Dr. Weaver has recently returned to administer and teach general anesthesia in the OSU Hospital operating rooms 2 days per week. Dr. Weaver, it's really, really nice to have you. I appreciate that. I appreciate you coming. And for those of you that are listening, Dr. Weaver was my professor in anesthesiology. He taught us pharmacology, and I think he did a great job. And, of course, he got up early to be here, and I just want to thank you for doing that.
Oh, you're welcome. Good morning, Brian. I recall you as a very, very good student, and am proud for what you've done so far in your career.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I didn't even know if you remembered my name. So that's always good to know. Dr. Weaver, there are lots of questions out in the world as far as anesthesia in the dental office, anywhere from local to general. And one of the things that I personally have a question is, when is it, or what prompted the Ohio, I mean, when I graduated from dental school, any dentist could do intravenous sedation, oral sedation, anything they wanted. But there came a point, and I believe it was about 1985, where the Ohio Dental Board decided that there needed to be a licensure process, a certification. Do you remember what, I mean, what prompted that?
Well, I think it goes clear back to 1974.
Wow.
Before that, any dentist in Ohio could administer any drug with or without significant training, even general anesthesia. And as a result of a few unfortunately bad outcomes with people who were not bright enough to recognize that general anesthesia should be something that should be administered only by those who have had significant training in general anesthesia, the Ohio Dental Board was the first state in the entire nation to come up with a permitting process, whereas the dentist who believed that he or she had sufficient training would apply to the dental board. The dental board develops specific criteria to provide a permit to give general anesthesia to those dentists who deserve to have it. And since then, almost every other state has followed Ohio's dental board's lead in that regard. Then that lasted for about 10 years, and then other states started to say if it is good to have a permitting process for general anesthesia, perhaps to ensure the safety of the public, there should also be a permitting process for other types of sedation that's not quite exactly general anesthesia, but rather a lesser form of sedation, but nevertheless, without significant training, perhaps there should be a permitting process to differentiate those dentists who actually should be doing it versus those who should not. So, again, the Ohio Dental Board was one of the leaders in the country, although not the first in regards to sedation permitting process, to say that, you know, if you're going to do sedation, you should have training.
Okay. Well, obviously, the Dental Board is here to protect the public. We had Lily Wrights, executive director of the Dental Board, on our show several weeks ago, and you know, I made it clear, and she did, that they exist to protect the public, and I think Ohio should be commended for being the first to do that. Certainly, I want to make sure that I'm doing, you know, the right thing by my patients, and I'm not putting them at risk. Well, first of all, Am I right in saying that general anesthesia, as we know it, was invented or discovered by a dentist?
Yes. Clear back in 1844, a dentist in Hartford, Connecticut, named Horace Wells, went to a circus-type magic show where laughing gas was being administered to volunteers who would come up on stage. They would breathe what is called nitrous oxide, otherwise known as laughing gas. And they would start laughing and do funny things, and
like this,
make a fool of themselves while temporarily inebriated with laughing gas. And he noticed that one fellow fell and actually hurt his leg fairly severely. And yet, when he came back after the performance on the stage, he didn't even know that he had injured himself.
So he was bleeding or something, so you would have expected him to be in pain, but
yes,
he wasn't?
And he wasn't in pain until finally the effects of the nitrous oxide finally wore off. So Horace thought, boy, I think this laughing gas might be something that might be useful in his own dental practice. to alleviate the pain of dental extraction, because that was 50 years before, 40 years before the invention of local anesthetics. And so he went back to his office and had one of his partners named Dr. Riggs.
Don't tell me he rigged something up.
Yeah, right. He took one of Horace Wells' teeth out.
Oh.
While this magician-type person named Gardner Quincy Colton gave him the nitrous oxide. And Horace exclaimed, "This is fantastic. I didn't remember a thing, and it didn't hurt." And so Horace Wells began doing this in his office of providing painless extractions and became fairly famous for that. Several years later, he took his invention to the Massachusetts General Hospital to show them that he could do surgery painlessly. And in fact, his experimentation in front of an audience didn't work exactly as he thought, because I think his nitrous oxide was somewhat diluted by room air. So it was an unsuccessful demonstration. 2 years later, however, another dentist named named William T.G. Morton, who had been experimenting with ether, actually had given it to his dog and was able to put his dog to sleep and then wake his dog back up without any ill effects. So he put on a demonstration in front of the Massachusetts General Hospital faculty, and everyone was skeptical because of Horace Wells' previous failure. And in fact, the head surgeon of Mass General, John Collins Warren, after Morton gave a successful ether anesthetic to allow a painless surgical procedure, he said, "Gentlemen, this is no humbug." And because it had been done in front of this audience at Mass General Hospital, a very prestigious hospital, the word went around the world, actually, very quickly about this great discovery. And so Morton, in fact, is probably the father of general anesthesia in the whole world.
Wow, that's really neat. Now, but what I'm hearing is this all got started in a circus sideshow, right? I mean, how many medical discoveries started there, I wonder?
I have no idea.
I mean, I'm glad that it did.
Yeah.
I think we're all better for it, but that's very interesting. What's the training required then to be able to administer sedation in the dental office? We talked about how there became this certification process, and what does that entail?
Well, I guess we can start from the top with general anesthesia. There are some dentists, most notably oral surgeons, who have general anesthesia training in the operating room, and also dentist anesthesiologists who have actually even more training in the operating room in a minimum of a 2-year full-time training program. And those dentists in Ohio are certainly eligible for a general anesthesia permit.
That's 2 years of nothing but general anesthesia training.
To be a dentist anesthesiologist,
yes.
Correct.
Okay.
Then for dentists who want to just sedate their patients and make them more relaxed but somewhat drowsy, there are different gradations of sedation. Actually, for adult patients, we know that our dentists in this state are trained well in dental school to administer nitrous oxide and oxygen combination, laughing gas, basically,
yes,
for conscious sedation. It's called minimal sedation, and it's a very, very safe procedure, and dentists in Ohio don't need any additional training beyond that which they get in dental school in order to administer nitrous oxide to adults and children. It's a very, very nice technique. It's very safe.
So those are the two extremes. You have the 2 years of nonstop for general anesthesia, and then you have the within the curriculum of dental school for laughing gas or nitrous oxide. I think we need to go to a break, so we're going to ask you to hold off on those other two categories until we come back from our break. If you have questions for Dr. Weaver, you can call 821-1230 or send us an email to dentallyspeaking on talk1230@yahoo.com. You're listening to Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kvitko here on Talk 1230 WYTS.
Take your smile, please stay for a while now. Just take your time wherever you go.
Talk 1230 WYTS. You're listening to Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kvitko. Good morning. Thank you for joining us. I'm general dentist Dr. Brian Kvitko, and in the studio with me is Dr. Joel Weaver. Dr. Weaver is a dental anesthesiologist and a professor emeritus at The Ohio State University. Very, very knowledgeable on this subject. And let me just go to the phones here in a second, because I want to reiterate the question of the day, which was, according to the ADA, a survey that was done, as of 2006, what percent of dentists surgically place implants? And I'm saying that, reiterating that now, because I know we have June from Worthington on the phone, and June has a guess, and I believe a question for Dr. Weaver. Good morning, June.
Good morning.
How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. A little cloggy, but
a little cloggy?
Otherwise.
Oh, it's early.
All right, well, which do you want first?
What would your guess be for our question of the day?
I guess about 30%.
30%?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to write that down. Actually, that is a little high. Maybe I shouldn't give that hint out, but thank you for your guess. And then go ahead with your question. Dr. Weaver's here listening.
Yes, Dr. Weaver, I'm going to be 80 years old this July, and I'm thinking of having the transplant or the plant for the my lower dentures. And I wonder, is there a limit to how old a person can be safely sedated?
That's a very good question, June. Age is not a huge factor. It's how healthy you are. At whatever age you are. So there are some 50-year-olds that are not very good candidates because they have a significantly compromised problems medically. But if you're young and healthy at 80, then certainly you can have some sedation and have your dental implant.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much, June, for that call. And before the break, Dr. Weaver was explaining the requirements, educational requirements, to be licensed first for general anesthesia, then for laughing gas or nitrous oxide, and now there's another category or two that you were about to explain to us.
Right, correct, Brian. As we said, minimal sedation with nitrous oxide, any dentist in the state of Ohio, they've all had enough training in dental school to provide that that modality safely for adults and children. For oral sedation, at least for adults, that is patients older than 12, that any dentist in the state of Ohio has the training to give a single dose of a sedative drug. Typically a drug perhaps like Valium, for instance, a little oral Valium, or another type of drug, but basically they're fairly similar in what they do to help patients relax a little bit so that the dental procedure is less stressful. For children, because children are a bit tricky in terms of sedation, the Ohio Dental Board requires a specific training in oral sedation of children. And therefore, for instance, pediatric dentists typically have this type of additional training to give oral drugs to sedate children.
When you say 12, do you mean 13, or do you mean older than 12?
I think the cutoff is for pediatrics is 12 or under.
Okay,
so you have to be 13.
13.
You have to be a teenager in order to be able to have oral sedative in a dentist's office, or a dentist without specific training. Other than what they get in dental school.
Okay, so unless they have a special certificate, which we're going to explain next,
right.
It's that one dose for anyone 13 and older,
right.
In a 24-hour period.
Correct.
Okay.
So and so the dentist takes into consideration a number of factors in terms of age and size and health, and then administers a dose of an oral drug that would be safe and yet hopefully enough to be effective.
Okay.
Then there is actually a combination of a single dose of a typical sedative drug plus nitrous oxide on top. So that's even still within the category of minimal sedation that any dentist in the state of Ohio can do for adult patients. There are other ways to administer sedative drugs as well. And in order to give multiple doses of oral drugs in the dental office, or to be able to give them parenterally, that means by intravenous or intramuscular injection, the dentist would also have to have significantly more education and training than what typically is given to the average dentist in the state. So if they complete enough hours of additional education, then they have the potential to get a sedation permit that would provide them the opportunity to give drugs, sedative drugs, intravenously.
Okay. I'm going to ask you a question now. I'm going to wait for your answer till after the break. The question is, how many dentists in the state of Ohio have that certification? Are you familiar? And maybe you could find out if you don't know. You're listening to Dentally Speaking here on Talk 1230, WY2TS. We'll be right back. Talk 1230, WYTS. You're listening to Dentally Speaking here on Talk 1230. And today in the studio, we have Dr. Joel Weaver, who is a dentist anesthesiologist. And he is a professor emeritus at The Ohio State University. Taught me anesthesia, not general, but anesthesia in dental school. And also was instrumental in teaching me what I needed to know to be able to do conscious sedation, which is the old term. Now it's called light and moderate and deep sedation is a new terminology that has been developed. But Dr. Weaver had just explained what the differences were. We had the light, which is nitrous oxide. We had general, which people seem to know. And then there is the moderate sedation, which can be either intravenous or oral. And I was going to ask Dr. Weaver, what are the differences and when would you use one over the other?
One of the problems with oral sedation is that when drugs are absorbed in the stomach in patients, there's a high variability of the rapidity with which the drugs are absorbed. So if you take a pill to help relax, it might work in a half an hour, it might take an hour, it might even take 2 hours. And so the dentist, by and large, just has to make an educated guess based on the patient's history and their size and their medical condition as to what would be the appropriate dose and go with it and hope that the procedure then would start at about the same time that the drug has its maximum effect. So that can potentially be a problem if you're one who absorbs it much more slowly than what most people do. When drugs are given directly into the vein, they work in basically a minute or two. And the nice part about that type of sedation is after a minute or two, if the initial dose isn't enough, then the dentist can give a little bit more and wait another several minutes, and if that's still not enough sedative to help the patient relax, then the dentist can give another small dose until the level of sedation is customized to the needs of a particular patient. Some patients are much more anxious than others. Some patients respond to sedative drugs at a lower dose. Some take a much higher dose. And so the beauty of intravenous sedation is that rather than having to guess at a dose that will be safe and that will be effective and that will have an onset at about the same time that the dentist wants to start the procedure, which is a problem with the oral route, the intravenous route allows the dentist to have the patient sedated to exactly the right level and then be able to start the procedure. So it takes more training for the dentist to be able to do that, but it's probably better in terms of making sure that the level of sedation is going to be just right for the patient and not too little and not too much.
So, and before that, thank you for that, and before we went to break, I'd asked you, do you know how many dentists are certified to provide this moderate sedation in the office in the state of Ohio?
I would have to. I could guess at that. Take a reasonable guess. Probably somewhere around 250 dentists probably have had the training to give moderate sedation.
And in the state of Ohio, I believe there are. I'm trying to remember how many dentists there are in the state of Ohio. I believe I was told somewhere in the neighborhood of 8,000. Does that sound about right?
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
And there are probably about an equal number of dentists who have general anesthesia permits in the state.
Okay, so, and those would be mostly oral surgeons, not exclusively, but mostly?
Correct.
Okay. So it's a relatively small number, and as you're hearing, it's something that should not be taken lightly, and which is why the dental board has limited those without the training to give one dose of oral just to be on the safe side. And so without that certificate, your dentist can give you one dose of whatever it is that they think is going to work. If it works, great. You can have your appointment. But if it turns out to be not enough, then you can't have any more for 24 hours. I've run into a couple of things. People are nervous, as you mentioned. And there are people that I actually give some oral sedative to before I sedate them intravenously. They're afraid of needles. They're afraid of everything. But I've run into a few people whose physician has prescribed for them Valium or some other sedative-type drug because they've told their physician they're afraid of dental appointments and they wanted something to relax them. And apparently the physician knows they're going to take this pill and drive themselves to the office. Now, when we sedate people, orally or otherwise, we don't let them drive themselves home. Have you heard of this, or, and what do you think of that? I mean, it just doesn't seem safe to me. I don't know.
I think there are two issues here. Drugs that can be administered orally in relatively low doses are taken by people every day, and you know they drive and they go to work, but perhaps they're going through a divorce or something, and they're prescribed a low dose of a drug like Valium to take two or three or four times a day. And certainly that's a concern to the public because, you know, if those patients take too much, then they could be impaired when they're driving. So although that's commonplace in medicine to have patients go to work and drive and be on low doses of some of these anti-anxiety drugs, if they're used in larger doses for their sedative effects, then certainly the patient shouldn't be driving. By and large, dentists
should or should not be driving.
They should not be driving themselves to the dental office. So, dentists generally treat patients who are afraid, and what the doses they use are sedative doses, and you know they shouldn't drive. And in fact, I think that rather than have sedative drugs prescribed by two different practitioners, it's probably a better idea to have just one doctor giving you the medication. And so I would argue that the dentist should be the one, if it's a dental procedure, should be the one in charge of prescribing all sedative drugs to the patient and not have the patient take some sedation drugs from their physician and then have the dentist add more drugs on. Perhaps that the combination of both what the physician gave the patient and what the dentist gave the patient could end up to be too much.
Right, right. And I've actually encouraged, or well, I've told my patients, let's just, not take whatever it is that you were prescribed, other than their maintenance dose, of course, if they're supposed to take a 0.25 Xanax or something, and they do it every day, I consider that normal, and then anything above that is a sedative. And so, yeah, we need to have the understanding and control over the amount of that drug. And when they leave our office, we do not let them drive home, which is a little bit of an inconvenience, but I think it's well worth it. We do have to go to a break again. And when we come back, we'll take your questions at 821-1230. Or remember, you can send us an email to dentallyspeakingontalk1230@yahoo.com. You're listening to Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kvitko. We'll be right back. 1230 WYPF. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kvitko. And I'm General Dentist Dr. Brian Kvitko. And today we're talking about sedation and pain control in dentistry. And in the studio with us, we have a guest, Dr. Joel Weaver, who is an anesthesiologist. He's a dentist. He is a PhD. He is Professor Emeritus at The Ohio State University. He's been very gracious to get up this early and come in and help us understand this whole business about sedation and pain control in a dental office. Before I go back to Dr. Weaver, I wanted to give, we had an email guest, Clara emailed a guest for a question of the day, which was, as of 2006, according to an ADA survey, what percent of dentists surgically placed implants? And her guess was 10%. So, Clara, thank you for that. It is a little bit low, so we're kind of zeroing in on it. You might remember June called in from Worthington a 30% guess. So we're somewhere between 30% and 10% as a hint. And we will get the answer out later on in the show. So we were talking about the difference in laughing gas, in general anesthesia, in moderate sedation. And we talked about how many dentists are certified. My permit happens to be number 28, which means I'm the 28th person in the state of Ohio to be doing this. I don't know if numbers 1 through 27 have died yet, but maybe I'll move up the food chain a little bit. But actually, I know they don't take numbers away. So, but it was the curriculum, just from personal experience, I should tell you, is it's a little bit rigorous. It's not something that is a slam dunk. You can flunk. You have to take advanced cardiac life support, which is taken along with emergency medical technicians. It does get pretty technical. And once you have your certificate, I believe it's relatively easy to maintain it by taking the required courses that are given. They're given, I think, two times a year. I think you're required to take one every year or every two. I can't remember. But whatever it is, I can promise you that. All right, now, we talked about patients who come to the office already sedated from their physician and the difference there, and how if you're going to be sedated for a procedure, it'd be best to let your dentist handle that and not, you know, grab a couple pills from your physician on the way out the door, because that could cause us to have more drug in you than we realize and maybe get into an unsafe situation. I do have a question for Dr. Weaver. He's the expert. How long after a person is sedated for oral sedation should they wait before driving again? And then a follow-up question would be, how long after intravenous sedation before they can drive themselves? Because I have my people, sometimes they have to leave their car there. They drive themselves, friend takes them home, but somewhere later on that day or the next, they need to come back for their car. And I get asked all the time, how many hours do I need to wait?
Well, that's a good question, Brian. A common practice is to not drive or make important decisions for the rest of that day. So starting the next day should not be a problem, because the drugs we use are generally fairly short-acting, and most of the time patients are pretty much back to normal 6 or 8 hours later, but nevertheless, it's probably still best just not to drive the rest of the day, and that just is an extra safety precaution.
Now, somebody has a 5 o'clock appointment and we're finished at 6. They can't drive the rest of that day, meaning they come back in the morning. But is it 6 to 6 a.m.? No, so 12 hours. So if they had a 7 a.m. appointment and they wanted to come back for their car at 9 at night, and I've been asked this, I'm not trying to get picky, I'm just trying to answer. These are the questions I get. So what would you say if they had a 7 a.m. appointment, we finished with them at, say, 8, could they come back at 9, or it really doesn't matter when you have it that day, they should come back the next day?
The way it's generally practiced is that the state of the art and is just to not drive the rest of that day, no matter what time your procedure is.
Okay.
And then, even then, you still want to make sure that you feel up to it.
Yes. But they think they feel up to it.
Well, sometimes the drug is totally gone, but perhaps you just need a nice hot shower just to get going again.
Okay.
And
okay.
So it's just best to have a nice good night's sleep, and then the next day, if assuming you feel perfectly fine, and you should be fine, then it's certainly safe to go back to work and drive.
And as you know, there are people, when you're walking them out the door, they're awake, they're alert, they think they're fine, and they say they want to drive, and they start asking questions. We know in about 5 hours they're not going to remember this conversation, and so there's that danger that a person is going to appear able to drive or think they're able to drive, and we actually watch and make sure they don't like sneak into their car and drive themselves home. We make sure that they have somebody with them.
I think sometimes that's a male ego that that the wife is going to drive them home, and they say, you know, move over, you know, I'm a better driver at,
exactly,
drunk
than you are
with you wide awake. But that's, you know, you just can't afford to
can't let
have
them
a
do
problem
that.
And even though a lot of these newer drugs do make you feel like you're back to normal fairly quickly, there's still some lingering effects that they may not be aware of. And that's why it's so important that the escort that takes the patient home stays with the patient and makes sure that they don't do something silly the rest of the day.
Okay.
And they probably shouldn't be out there with a frying pan in the kitchen cooking
or
dinner.
A turkey fryer, huh?
No. You know, some bad things can happen.
Themselves on fire. No, we don't want that.
Concentrating. So just go home and lie down on the couch and watch TV, read the paper,
okay,
and get a good night's sleep.
All right. Well, that's good advice. We have on the line with us Matthew in Columbus, but we're going to ask Matthew if he can hold off till after the break because we do have to go to a commercial. And remember, our question of the day is, what percent of dentists, according to a 2006 ADA survey, surgically place implants, and that we've narrowed it down to somewhere between 10% and 30%. We'll take your guesses and your questions when we return. You're listening to Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kvitko here on Talk 1230 WYTS. Talk 1230 WYTS. You're listening to Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kvitko, also known as Everything You've Always Wanted to Know About Dentistry, but We're Too Numb to Ask. Before we go to the phones, and I thank you, Matthew, for staying on hold so long with us, I want to let people know that this show is available by podcast by going to www.talk1230wyts.com. Once you go there, hold your mouse over the on-air icon, drop-down box appears, click on Dr. Kvitko, takes you to my page. In the middle of that page, it says click here to go to podcast page, click there, and then you just left-click on the word listen to any of the shows that we've done in the past. There are several there for you to choose. All right, Matthew, thank you for holding, and you are on the air with Dr. Kvitko. What's your question? Oh, did you also have a guest? I'm sorry. Did we lose Matthew?
Oh, my bad. I'm going to say 17%.
17%? Actually, that's very, very close. I'm going to go ahead and give the answer so we don't run long. In case we run long, the answer is 16%, actually 15.9, but we were going to round up anyway because we knew people couldn't pick that. So, very good. All right, Matthew, Dr. Weaver is here in the studio. I'm not sure if your question is for me or for him, but go ahead with your question.
It's kind of for both you doctors. Does laughing gas actually make you laugh, like, pretty much out loud, or does it kind of just put you in, like, an euphoric mood?
You know, what mood? What kind of mood?
Like, euphoric.
Kind of euphoric.
Kind of, like, days, but kind of happy. I've always, you know, watching television, they have everyone, you know, laughing out loud, and I would think that'd be pretty disruptive.
Trying to do dentistry like that? Yeah, I think I'll let Dr. Weaver answer that. He looks ready to go.
History tells us that sometimes patients laugh, but for the most part, it makes them feel euphoric. It helps take the weight off of their mind about an upcoming procedure, if it normally is something that is a bit scary for them. It helps them relax, and sometimes people laugh. but generally, it's just a nice, comfortable, warm feeling that it produces and helps relax the patient.
Yeah, my experience has been very, very few actually laugh out loud. Although I have a couple that they laugh just like they were in that Mary Poppins movie where they're all laughing so hard they float up to the ceiling. And I thought this person in particular was kind of, you know, playing it up and kind of faking it. And so he's just laughing, and I can't get anything done, and he's laughing. And unbeknownst to him, I had slowly turned the gas down. I reached back, turned it down a little bit, still laughing, reached down, turned a little bit, and then finally, I reached down and turned it down a little more, and he goes, "Hey, what happened?" So it was clearly the gas making him laugh, but, and you're right, we would not have been able to do dentistry on him had that continued in that way. But, yeah, it's more euphoria. And I think, I don't know if you're listening at the beginning of the show, but when Horace Wells first discovered this, they were not using the mixture of nitrous that we use today. They probably had 100% nitrous, am I right, Dr. Weaver?
Possibly, yes.
Yeah, which isn't safe. We're only allowed to deliver 70%, and at 70%, you will not get the profound pain control like that patient in the circus who had hurt his leg and maybe was bleeding but didn't even know he had hurt himself. And so people out there who have had nitrous are saying, "Hey, there's no way that stuff's going to work on a gash in my leg," but that's the difference, and we want to keep it safe for everybody out there. So thank you for your question, Matthew, and I do want to say I want to thank Dr. Weaver for being my guest and getting up early. It's very early, as you know, and I appreciate you listeners for doing the same. I feel fortunate to have Dr. Weaver willing to do this and come on my show. And boy, there's so much more that we could talk about. Maybe I can ask him to be on the show again sometime down the road. Next week, I will be out of the studio. I will have a guest host. Gail Hogan is going to be my guest host, and she'll be in the studio here with a guest. And I may call in, but my son is getting married next Saturday, and I'll be too far away to actually be here to do a broadcast. So please tune in, though, because Gail Hogan will have a very interesting show for you. And don't forget to come out to the Buddy Walk if you have a moment, or make a donation in behalf of Libby's Tooth Buds. You're listening to Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kvitko here on Talk 1230 WYTS. Thanks for listening.